City Talk.
The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall.
Simon Hughes, of course, celebrated author. And he's just got his brand new book out, Ring of Fire, Liverpool FC into the 21st Century, The Players' Stories. Morning to you, Simon.
Morning, Steve.
It must be quite nice as an author just to get your hands on your new book. You know, when you get it for the first time, is it almost like having your new baby every time you look at it?
I wouldn't put it that far, Steve. but yeah, I mean, you know, there's been 12 to 18 months work that's gone into this and some quite stressful periods, particularly, I mean, the stress comes when you're trying to ensure that you get an interview, really. The enjoyable part is writing it up, because you never quite know what you're going to get until you actually meet people. You know, I'm sure you'll talk about this in the interview here, but, you know, it took a bit of time trying to sort Fernando Torres out and trying to explain to him, you know, exactly what I was trying to do. And, you know, to convince him that it was a good idea to speak. So that's where the stress is. And then, you know, obviously in this decade, a lot of the footballers are from different parts of the world, or certainly different parts of Europe anyway. So it involved quite a lot of travel. And but yeah, it was great. And I'm pleased with the feel of the book and the look. It's very bright, the cover.
Yeah, because sometimes players can be suspicious, can't they, of why you're writing it. And you're not writing it for sort of devious intentions, but you want to find a few stories that people don't quite know. Now, the interesting thing about this book, it's the players' story. So it's between 2000 and 2010. It's not necessarily a narrative of the football that went throughout those years. It's individual people and their stories and their perception of it. So it might be Phil Thompson from the early 2000s, Danny Murphy, of course, Michael Owen and Houllier. Neil Mellor as well. But then obviously the Hermans, the Alonsos, the Carragers, the Rick Parry who spanned it all, and the Fernando Torres. And there's some great tales in there which we'll get into individually. What was the temptation initially to steer clear of doing that narrative of just this is how it went chronologically?
Well, I mean, I was a bit wary about doing this book initially, because I've done two other books about Liverpool in the 80s and Liverpool in the 90s. And obviously the players there, they're slightly more accessible, and you know, the story is already there for those two decades. Whereas this decade, I felt that a lot has been written about it. Obviously, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, there's been just generally more writing about football. You know, if you look at the online presence, there's just so much written about football. And I'm probably going to contradict you a little bit, because, I mean, although it's certainly not, you know, the book's certainly not a tale of Istanbul and the treble season and stuff like that, but there is a link between each interview in terms of a narrative of the decade. And it's just trying to get to the bottom of some of the things that maybe, you know, people weren't quite aware of. And you know, I suppose there's a bit of misconception about certain, you know, certain characters in the book. You know, you mentioned Michael Owen, Fernando Torres being two of them. You know, try and get their side of the story about, you know, and try and get their feelings about how they're viewed. I think it's actually quite an emotional book in some ways, because you tend to think that modern footballers are emotionless and don't have many feelings, but quite clearly, you know, that these players, they talk about things that have happened to them that have affected them and have affected their decision making, you know, processes. So maybe I hope that people will read it and see them perhaps in a slightly different light to common perception of the modern footballer, because, you know, I think the strength of the other books that I've done is that they kind of detailed different roads into football. You know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, players all had different paths into their football careers, whereas I think in the last 10 years, certainly, you know, it's all academy-led, it's all, you know, it's quite stage-managed. And Michael Owen goes into quite a lot of detail about that, about how, you know, he had his kind of career managed for him from an early age. And although it was like kind of reflection of him, it wasn't an absolute reflection of him. And, you know, perhaps if he'd had his chance again, he'd do things a little differently, because you kind of forget with Michael Owen, he was like a really aggressive player for Liverpool. You know, he scored hundreds of goals, and the ability to stand, you know, to perform on the biggest stage and deliver, you know, time and time again, which he did, I don't think that was really ever reflected in kind of the public image that he had. It was all kind of sweetness and light. And I think ultimately that probably affected the way Liverpool supporters thought about him as well, because it was quite clean cut. And at the time, you had Robbie Fowler, who was, you know, the opposite to that. Yeah. And Liverpool supporters could relate to that a lot more, you know, not to mention the England thing where, you know, it felt like Michael Owen was more England's player than Liverpool's player, perhaps. So yeah, I think, you know, fundamentally that affected the way he was viewed even before he left Liverpool. So we get into a lot of that in the interviews.
I think that's really interesting, the element you said about the personality traits and whether they fit Liverpool Football Club. Because as fans, we tend to like individual personalities and why they're so popular. And Robbie's a great example of that, isn't he? People from around here can relate to Robbie Fowler, and he's the perfect sort of fit. Fernando Torres, let's get on to him straight away. And obviously, I think he was one of the finest players I've watched in a red shirt. I still think that. If you said to me, who are your three favourites you watched, he would be in my top three. He had something about him, just something magical. How much of a perfect fit did he think he was for Liverpool before he arrived at the football club?
That's a good question, because he said that, you know, he'd going back to Michael Owen a little bit, he was saying, you know, that quite similarly, his career, again, had been quite stage managed at Atletico, because he was a young player. You know, he'd made his debut at 16, was captain at 18 or 19, I think. You know, the club's youngest ever captain. And by the time he decided to leave Atletico, he said it was very difficult to leave Atletico Madrid, but it wasn't hard to decide to join Liverpool, you know, because he said he could identify with a lot of Liverpool's values and you know, Atletico Madrid and a working class club. Now, this might seem a little bit shallow based on the fact that he eventually left to join Chelsea. But, you know, he does explain the reasons behind that.
And he gave you this line that Liverpool beat Real Madrid, so it was all acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
in Atletico fans' eyes.
Yeah, when you leave a club, you know, you've got to choose the destination wisely. I mean, you could look at Xabi Alonso, I suppose, who's obviously interviewed in the book, and he could have left for Arsenal under Benitez when it was quite clear that, you know, that Rafa was willing to sell him. Now, if he sells him to Arsenal, I wonder whether, you know, the relationship with Liverpool fans remains the same. So, you know, Fernando was quite clearly to me, the idea that it was all a ruse about, you know, like he didn't really love Liverpool, that's just not true. I think he did love playing for Liverpool. But ultimately, around that time, when Hicks and Gillette were the owners and the club was an absolute mess, I mean, you know, it can't be underestimated just how dire the situation was. Liverpool, as it was well documented, I'm not revealing anything new there, but it's easy to forget that, isn't it? You know, I think a lot of supporters stopped going to watch Liverpool at that time, and had fallen out of love with Liverpool. And I think quite similarly, Fernando Torres fell out of love with Liverpool, just got, you know, dragged down. He's quite an emotional person, introspective, and he thinks a lot about the way things are. You know, quite contrary to the perception of footballers, really. He, you know, I think it does affect his life, you know, when his work life is not happy, is not good. It was affecting his home life. He wasn't happy about, you know, the way things were being run at Liverpool, the direction of the club. And he did kind of touch on this as well. I thought this was quite interesting, because he did go at great lengths to stress that, like, he's an Atletico Madrid fan. You know, he's grown up and will always be an Atletico Madrid fan. He identified with Liverpool, and Liverpool is his club in England, despite this, you know, he goes, I don't want to give too much away, because he talks about later on in the interview that, you know, where it went wrong at Chelsea and how he pined for Liverpool, basically. But, you know, around the time, Liverpool were very keen to kind of to market him as, you know, kind of the foreign player that comes to Anfield and gets it all. And he went along with that to a large extent. You know, he did an autobiography of sorts where it was all about my Liverpool home. I think he kind of, you know, if he had his time again, he probably wouldn't maybe go along those lines, because the club are keen to make, you know, heroes out of these foreign stars as well. It's not just the player. You know, I think it suited the club to say, we've got Fernando Torres. And I think ultimately that led to his departure, because by the end, when he had discussions with Liverpool, all the discussions were based really around finance, not around football or the sport and results.
Did he have a weight of expectations, you think, on his shoulders? And was he when you met him, is he the sort of character that you thought, yeah, he can carry that?
I found him, it's difficult. I mean, if you say somebody's brittle, that means that they're, you know, it might be perceived that they're just brittle generally in life, whereas I think he's very aware of the surroundings and what's going on. When I interviewed him, he was very serious, you know, initially, like incredibly serious about the situation, because he'd never spoken about the manner of his departure from Liverpool particularly before, and gone on the record with all the details about his feelings on the issue. And he was very serious when he went in, and I got the impression he'd been carrying this around with him for obviously a long time. It's something that he does think about. Mm. And by the end of the interview, he had kind of lightened up, and it was a totally different character. He's far more I think he's far more complex than people probably appreciate. And even being honest, he'd probably admit himself, he can, I suppose, let a situation, you know, take over him, and he can be a little bit sulky. I think you saw that on the pitch. He didn't deny that, but a lot of people have said to me, oh, has he explained why for the last 18 months he didn't try? He explains to me in the book that basically for the last 18 months he was having to play a lot of games when he wasn't fit, because Liverpool didn't have a backup striker. When he signed for Liverpool had just finished... you know, they'd just been beaten in the Champions League final. He'd won the Champions League 2 years before. They were a team that were, you know, really on the European stage. They had other players in his position who could play games when he wasn't fit. But for the last 18 months, he had to play a lot of games when he wasn't fit, and had to come back too soon. And I think that has effect on his well-being and his physical capability to play to the highest standards.
He says in here, at times, I thought I was in one of the best team, if not the best team, yeah, in Europe, and it was quite hard to disagree. You looked at the spine of the side at that time, whether it be through, you know, your Reyners to your Mascheranos, mm, to your Alonsos to your Gerrards, isn't it? Mm. He thought he was in the team.
Yeah, well, it went from a situation very quickly where Liverpool were almost, you know, champions. I mean, that you can argue all day about who, you know, you always end up where you deserve to be, but in that 2008-2009 season, you know, Liverpool lost two league games, and it was the couple of draws that just cost them, and they probably did play the best football in the country that season, and in normal circumstances probably would have won the league, judging by the points that they had. They were obviously in the Champions League, they were competitive in every competition, and to go from that to a situation within 18 months where the club's in a virgin administration, you know, it's quite a dramatic fall, really. Now, I'm certainly not, I mean, I've said this in other interviews, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, people have heard this, but, you know, I'm certainly not a Fernando Torres apologist. Like, he does, you know, say he's not blameless in the manner of his departure.
It was a mess.
I mean, Liverpool had, you know, between 6 months and a year to sort this out, and they didn't. Unfortunately, you know, it ended the way it did. I mean, he felt that Liverpool were quite happy for him to go by the time, you know, 6 months before, basically, but the circumstances weren't right because there was a takeover with the club. Liverpool were saying to him, we can't sell our best players because obviously that drives the value down of the club, because obviously, you know, he was an asset, but he was viewing that, well, you don't really care about the sport, you know, the football, you're just caring about, you know, Liverpool retaining its value. The messages coming out of the club were just all wrong, and it just led to this kind of general, you know, unhappiness, I think. And ultimately, at the end, you know, he thinks that Liverpool were quite happy to sell him. I mean, that might have been a consequence of his performances, his mood around the training ground. But he certainly feels that, you know, the word that he used was, I was the only one and I took maximum responsibility for the outcome. And he said, I don't feel it was like that, which is, you know, that's where I get into a lot of detail in the book around that theme.
Is he still feeling a little bit of sadness?
Yeah.
About, you know, a tinge of upset about how he did come back, didn't he, of course, for that charity, yeah, game, which he played with Stephen Gerrard and a few of the others. But his sort of story mirrors, if you like, Liverpool Football Club as a whole in that decade, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The highs of the brilliance and the success of him, yeah, individually, the lows of the mess and the financial chaos that surrounded his departure. He almost mirrors the club entirely, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, yeah. I mean, I think that's the point that I suppose it needs to be made, that Liverpool, when he joined Liverpool, were flying, you know, they were one of the most competitive teams in European competition. And by the time they left, they were... pretty much, I'm trying to remember, they had been in the bottom half of the league. You know, they were out of the Champions League. Obviously, FSG had taken over, but they'd decided to go down a slightly different route. And Fernando was very honest about, mm, that. He said, I was 27. You know, I was thinking, if they want to, like, kind of develop the club, by signing young players. It's going to take time to do that. He was concerned, you know, that he might not, you know, he might not be around long enough to see the benefits of that. I mean, he didn't use the word regret, but it was quite clear that he, as he's got older, he looks life and his career slightly differently. He said when he was that age, you know, he's 32 now, he was motivated by winning, you know, and he's realised having won, as he did with Chelsea in the Champions League, it certainly doesn't bring the level of contentment as a human being that, you know, you think it might do. He said, I mean, he contemplates in the book whether he should just have stayed at Atletico Madrid his whole career and then he'd have been a hero forever for everybody. But then he said that would have then meant that he wouldn't have played for Liverpool, which was his happiest time in his football career. You know, he does have a lot of sympathy with the fans as well, because he said that, you know, he can understand why the fans, you know, absolutely, understandably turned against him after going to Chelsea, because he said that ultimately the fans care about the club, you know, that not, and he said not one player is bigger than the club, and if they've got to heckle me, they have to do that. He said he completely understands that, but I got the impression that it's too strong to say it, but he struggled to almost forgive himself for the way it all ended, really, and I think you could tell that. The way he played for Chelsea, people will say, well, his physical capacity had declined by then, and maybe it had, but with a better mental mindset, he might have performed better. It's difficult to kind of quantify how much of an impact that will have had.
This is Radio City Talk. Rock, sport and talk for Liverpool.
This is Radio City Talk.
We are talking with Simon Hughes, author of the brilliant new book Ring of Fire. It explores all sorts of stories from different individuals at Liverpool Football Club between 2000 and 2010. The foreword is by Stephen Gerrard. You had to really get involved in the book, didn't you? I'm sure he was delighted to do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did think about interviewing Stephen, obviously him being in LA kind of complicates issues slightly, but I just felt that he had to have a presence there. I mean, Stephen's obviously done his own autobiography less than a year ago, and although again a fascinating, more complex character than people perhaps think, ultimately I just thought it'd be nice to have him, you know, doing the foreword and overlooking the book, because obviously his whole like Liverpool career was centered around this decade, so he's kind of, I suppose, a guardian looking over the book.
Oh, his name dominates the decade, yeah. Doesn't it, really? I mean, nothing of what was achieved was achievable without him because of the characteristics and the link he had. He was sort of the linchpin of it all, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'm got a slightly different view because I'm 32 now, so I haven't seen players like play live like Kenny Dalglish, and I saw the end of John Barnes, who was obviously a fantastic player in the late 80s. But, you know, Stephen Gerrard, for me, I think is kind of the club icon, you know, the greatest modern player, certainly. So it was, I suppose, a big decision to kind of think, oh, well, I'm going to leave him out in terms of not interview him
He features
regularly throughout the book.
Right, I think we're sometimes really interested in hearing from different individuals that we don't get the background on. So, for example, your Fernando Torres interview was great because he doesn't speak to journalists. So, for the first time ever, we hear a little bit more about why he left, his loves of Liverpool, you know, what it was like being part of Liverpool Football Club. Someone else who, again, and he's not really part of the conversation, is he, when you talk about that era, is Rick Parry.
Yeah.
And yet he was the main decision maker. You've sat down with him, and Rick actually he's a really interesting character. He's a very, very clever man, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he takes a lot of time to sort of think about a question when you ask it him. You know, there's a good 3-4 second pause and you're thinking, am I going to fall into this hole? But you've got some great stuff out of Rick Parry here, including the search for a manager. So in 2004, David Moores is talking with Rick Parry about the possibilities of where they go next for a manager. And Jose Mourinho's name comes up. So this isn't just a rumour. They very much had Mourinho on a shortlist, did they?
Well, it's not quite like that, I suppose. I mean, what happened was Gerard Houllier, the discussion about Gerard Houllier hadn't even started about whether to replace him. I mean, Liverpool had a really bad season that year. They qualified for the Champions League, but they were further behind the top place position in the Premier League than they had before. And it was March time, and Porto were playing Manchester United at Old Trafford in the Champions League, and obviously Porto would go on and win the Champions League that year. And the story goes from Rick is that it's typical football, really. A Portuguese agent who will remain unnamed, although people might be able to figure out who this agent is, you know, if they do a bit of research, was on Merseyside that morning of the Manchester United game at Old Trafford, and was chatting with Gerard Houllier, ostensibly about selling and signing players for Liverpool, Portuguese players, possibly from Porto. Later on that day, the Portuguese agent knocked on Rick Parry's door and tried to see whether Liverpool were interested in appointing Jose Mourinho as Houllier's replacement. So on one hand, he was trying to sell Houllier players, and on the other hand, he was trying to get him sacked.
So it was the other way around,
And Rick was, you know, apparently the agent had told Rick that Mourinho was, you know, very big on Liverpool and was interested in coming to the Premier League and, you know, knew all about Liverpool's history, etc. And was just trying to get the feelers out for whether Liverpool would be interested, because obviously there was a lot of interest in Mourinho at that time. And Rick's response quite rightly was, well, we haven't, you know, come to a decision about Gerrard yet, and Liverpool were trying to qualify for the Champions League, and he didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to be railroaded into a decision, you know, before and potentially jeopardise trying to get in the Champions League. Because as the point that he makes, if Liverpool decide to dispense with Houllier, that becomes public. Liverpool might not finish in the Champions League position. And then 2005 in Istanbul may not happen, you know. So they wanted to do things the right way. Obviously, the opportunity was there to speak to Mourinho, but Liverpool decided not to in the end and ultimately arrived with Rafa Benitez. And I think what happened later on that night as well, when Porto played United and equalised quite late on in the game at Old Trafford, and Mourinho reacted by running down the touchline, you know, celebrating with his players in the corner flag. I could imagine Rick sitting there thinking, we can't have a Liverpool manager doing that at Old Trafford, ultimately, because it would probably start a riot, wouldn't it? And ultimately, they arrived at the decision that Rafa Benitez was a better fit for Liverpool.
How much of a part did Rick Parry play, do you feel, within the years that Rafa Benitez were there and five very successful years, you know, two Champions League finals, the FA Cups, the trips to the Worthington Cup? As I said before, he's not really the name that you essentially comes out in conversation a lot. But if you look deeper... When you spoke to him, how much do you feel that he think he played a part in within that?
He's clearly a very talented administrator, despite, you know, and I know he divides opinion for a variety of reasons, and a lot of that is based around, you know, the sale of the club to Hicks and Gillette. I mean, he goes into a lot of detail there about how that happened, and there were a lot of things that did happen that maybe people didn't realise, which Liverpool essentially backed into a corner by the time they sold to Hicks and Gillette. And consequentially, you know, he had a relationship with Rafa Benitez that was, you know, quite fraught. He's very open about that as well, and explains why. But, you know, as Rick says, when he went into Liverpool to replace Peter Robinson, the idea, you know, it was all about football. It was all about making sure Liverpool were a successful football team. You know, that's the most important thing. It wasn't about maximising revenues on shirt deals, on sponsorships. It was all about, we have to make Liverpool successful on the pitch. And if Liverpool is successful on the pitch, the rest will come. And I suppose, not that he's taking credit for, you know, managers delivering success, but when Liverpool were there, you know, they won almost everything there was to win. So I suppose you compare that and contrast it with the period since, the people who have been running the club since. Is the focus really on, you know, winning trophies? Is the focus on instead trying to make Liverpool a commercial financial power? Now, that's not being critical of FSG or Ian Ayre or even Christian Pearslow kind of before him. It's basically saying, you know, have they got the strategies the wrong way around? You know, what leads to one, you know, does the football success drive the commercial, or should the commercial drive the football success? You know, whoever gets that balance right, you know, is a genius. I know Rick feels quite, you know, strongly about there's an argument always levelled at him about how after Liverpool won the Champions League, the club shop at Anfield was shut the next morning.
Story, yeah.
You know, a story that gets peddled around all the time. And his argument is, well, you know, everybody at Liverpool who work with, I mean, you've got to remember in 2005, Liverpool was a much smaller organisation. There weren't as many people working for the club. And the people that did work went to Istanbul. So his idea was, well, everybody should share the glory. And as he argues quite correctly, you know, the glow of Istanbul, it wasn't going to be defined commercially by what happened the next morning. You know, it's 10 years later, the club is still, if we're being honest, dining out on that success. And it's wearing a little bit thin now, in my opinion. So, you know, they've got to find other ways of making Liverpool success, new stories for people to write about, new...
So you could argue that what he did was correct.
Well, you could do, yeah.
Does he feel slightly bittersweet about the two ways in which he's perceived? Yeah. Or in fact, maybe even the one way, because obviously by the time he had left the football club, all people talk about now is the American owners.
Yeah, well, I think with a position like his, the chief executive, you know, everyone's always going to... I mean, there were lots of other things going on. There was the stadium debate as well, which Liverpool never got over the line. Mm. That's one thing which you could say, I suppose, with FSG, although it's taken them, you know, it's taken them 6 years to get to the position where, you know, we're looking across the city now, brilliant new stands. It's taken 6 years. It's hardly been an overnight, you know, revolution. Mm. That's a long time in football. And I suspect that will be their legacy. But I think Rick understands that everybody will ultimately have an opinion about the job that he does, but ultimately his opinion is the only one that gets tested week in, week out. And I think his reaction to that was, you know, not to read the papers, and not, because you go absolutely crazy, wouldn't you, if you read into everything that everybody was writing and saying about you, listening to the phone-ins. I mean, I can only imagine if that situation was happening now, almost 10 years later, with the social media. You know, everybody's angry about everything all the time now, aren't they? I think he can rationalise that. But, you know, fundamentally, if you look back at that period of time while he was there, I think, other people might disagree, but Liverpool's operations were based on sporting interests. And for me, that's what it should be about.
Okay, let's focus on another player and someone who's absolutely loved, of course, he is right across the city, but left far too early within his footballing career, and that was Xabi Alonso. We saw some of the best of him, but of course he's still playing at the highest level and starting week in, week out for Bayern Munich, which says an awful lot, 10 years on. Yeah. So you went to see Xabi Alonso, who's still got a love affair.
Yeah,
with the city and the football club.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I went to Bayern Munich's training grounds and watched him train, and you know, when you think Liverpool were considering selling him in 2008, which is 8 years ago, and he's still playing for, you know, one of the top three European clubs, playing regularly. I was watching him in a training session, and you know, there's a game of strings where there's a middleman in a circle, and they're all feeding the ball into him, and he was the one who was passing it really with all authority. And I think he's going to play every week this season as well under Carlo Ancelotti. So, you know, managers arrive at different decisions, different times for different reasons.
How did he leave?
Well, 12 months before he ultimately left Liverpool, Rafa Benitez had decided to sell him. And Xabi didn't want to leave, you know. But ultimately, Arsenal and Juventus were clubs that interested him, and neither of them made an offer that was acceptable to Liverpool. So he stayed, and then he had 12 months where he probably played his best football for Liverpool. That 2008-09 season, arguably Liverpool's. But I mean, Liverpool had a lot of good players that season, but he played really, really well that season, and. You know, ended up going to Real Madrid. I think he was honest. He said, I decided I wanted to go by then. I think his relationship with Rafa Benitez had declined to the point where, although he wouldn't go on record saying that, you know, declined to the point where he felt like it was time to move on. And, you know, again, he chose the destination of his next club wisely. You know, Real Madrid, you know, nobody's going to begrudge that in the future. I mean, I think if you look at Xabi Alonso, you know, look at his career that he's had. I think if any, you know, footballer growing up could choose the career that he's had, you'd go for it. You know, playing for the hometown club in San Sebastian, Real Sociedad, you know, beautiful city, great education, intelligent guy, goes to Liverpool, ends up winning the Champions League, has the adoration of, you know, all the fans, more or less.
And immersed himself in the lifestyle,
lived on the Albert Dock, you know, walked around the streets, you know, really approachable guy, really, I mean... I certainly don't want to be a spokesman for how wonderful all these players are, because, you know, probably some of them aren't so wonderful, but Xabi, I think, is a really, you know, level-headed guy who understands, very, very personable, and I enjoyed his company.
And of course,
more than probably, you know, anyone else bar Jamie Carragher.
Well, there's also other sides to the story as well. Because, you know, and I've heard the other side of the story, which is the story that he himself wanted to leave, isn't it? It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, over 10 years, he'll be very firm in his head about what he said to you about he wanted to stay. But I think it was part of the chaos that maybe surrounded those few years.
I mean, I should probably rephrase that. I mean, I think that he didn't really want to feel driven out from the club. I don't think he was quite ready to leave. I mean, I know, obviously, there's one person who isn't interviewed in the book is Rafael Benitez. And I did try to get Rafa. But I think when there's a person who's still active in football, particularly somebody who, I suppose, divides opinion like Rafa, I think you probably only get like kind of the kind of interview that have been delivered in the book maybe once he's finished with his career. And I think the strength of the interviews in the books are the accountability of the stories, you know. And I didn't want it to become a book where, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, strong quotes from the players and the different managers and the coaches and the chief executive. And I felt that Rafa, you know, it probably isn't in a position to perhaps deliver that kind of analysis at this time because, you know, his head's at Newcastle, he's got lots going on. Yeah, I mean, I think the fallout from Alonso began when he decided, you know, that he didn't want to, he couldn't play in the Inter Milan game in the Champions League, and is he said he wanted.
Oh, his wife was giving birth, wasn't it?
And that season, you know, let it be said that Alonso wasn't playing particularly well as well. And I think Rafa Benitez thought, right, you know, we need a different player. It was a purely, you know, football decision, I think, in the end. Because his performances in that season have been quite poor for Liverpool. It's probably his worst season was followed by his best season. So yeah, I mean, I got the impression that it's, at that time, it may have made sense. But then he comes back and, like, I think motivated by the reality of trying to, you know, it seeming like he was going to be sold, kind of that motivated him, and he delivered his probably best form for Liverpool.
Right, we're talking about Ring of Fire, Simon Hughes' new book. It's out today. You can go and get your hands on it. Where? In Waterstones, anywhere?
Yeah, Waterstones, Pritchard and Crosby, I've got to say that. And, you know, it's available on Amazon. It's available everywhere.
Right, OK, you get your hands on it today. Some brilliant stories. We'll just finish on some Dietmar Hamann stories because I've got a soft spot for Diddy. I think he's just one of those that you just tend to. When you're in his company, he's almost the most sort of lazy.
Yeah.
Everything's sort of easy. It's sort of cool, isn't it? Yeah. And it's funny, you open up your interview with Dietmar, or Diddy, and he's talking about how he catched a fag off David Moores.
Yeah.
And I thought that's him all over, isn't it?
Yeah, classic. He's in the changing rooms after the Champions League final, beating Milan, and everyone's just sitting there in disbelief, and he decides the only way to react to this is find David Moores, because he's the only other smoker at the club, and have a cigarette in the shower room away from Rafa Benitez, who would have probably told him off. And so there they were, you know, standing together with David Moores, who was, I think, shaking just by the whole adrenaline of the evening, just having a quiet cigarette.
What's your favourite story in the book? Because you've gone to try and find the stuff, haven't you, that people haven't heard?
Yeah, well, I think it's a different book to like the 80s and 70s, the 80s and 90s, where you get, you know, a series of funny, you know, funny stories whereby, you know, this happened on a night out, that happened on a night out, because ultimately football has become a slightly more serious place in this decade. I mean, I just, in terms of the interviews that I enjoy doing, I mean, I've got a, you know, I know Jamie Carragher reasonably well. I think I've tried to portray him in a slightly different way, I suppose. His career, it's quite clear to me, was, you know, led largely by fear, you know, the fear of losing his place. And, you know, sitting down with him over the course of, you know, a couple of interviews and getting to the root and core of what motivated him, I really enjoyed that process. So, yeah, I'd probably say I enjoyed doing all the interviews. I can't be sitting on the fence there, aren't I? Xabi Alonso was great because, you know, I just think going to Bayern Munich, seeing how they train, seeing how he is as a person, seeing his viewpoint on life. He can explain football. He's got a very clear view and vision of football. And I'd be surprised if he didn't. People say this a lot about players. Any player who has a good idea of how football is and the way it should be played. But he should try management, I think.
It's a brilliant read. Ring of Fire. Some of the bits of praise it's had so far. At the Times says a top-class book. What else have we got? The Liverpool Echo says excellent. and The Independent. Do you not write for The Independent? Ah, that's says an excellent journey, packed with insight. That wasn't you, was it?
No.
No, it is great, isn't it? And I suppose you're going to be publicising it quite a bit over the next few days. I think you're going to be on with Saint and Snods at the weekend for a short bit as well, just to give another plug. But Ring of Fire, well done, Si.
Thanks.
That's
thanks
a lot of hard work, isn't it? Two years of your life.
18 months. 18 months, yeah.
Just about put it to one side.
Well, as soon as the last one finished, this one began pretty much. So.
And have you got another one in the pipeline?
Well, I've been working on an autobiography of another ex-player, which will be out next month. So I'll probably be in touch about that.
Okay, and this is for Rosalind, the other half, yeah?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Lovely. It's a bit embarrassing, that, isn't
very
it?
Sweet.
This is Radio City Talk. Rock, sport and talk for Liverpool.